May it please the court, my name is Martin Freeman, registration number 19263. Good afternoon. We are here today on an appeal from a jury verdict, which is quite remarkable. It is a case in which, and it is the principal reason we appealed it, although there is a second issue as well relating to some attorney's fees that were awarded. As to that, I think that that issue has been well briefed and we will not deal with that on oral argument. We are also here on an appeal, cross appeal by the defendants, some of the defendants.
Counsel, if I may, I don't want to lose your head of steam on the fees issues, which I know you're not going to address. Was that issue preserved?
I believe it was. The time period within which we, although I do recall in our opponent's brief, they said that it wasn't, but it was. We had a certain time period after judgment is entered within which to file a motion, an appropriate motion, and we did, and the judge never ruled on that, and 60 days passed, and it was deemed to be denied because of the passage of this
time. So you raised it in the motion for reconsideration, this issue of you're asking for fees that related to the other defendants. The
right.
First time you raised that was in the motion for reconsideration?
No, we opposed the original motion as well, Your Honor.
Right. And did you oppose it on those grounds? Did you raise that issue? I understood that you said, well, the district doesn't get fees because these other guys are still in the case, or your theory.
That's correct, and it was a refinement of that. We essentially acknowledged that some fees were due in the motion for reconsideration, but because other people were still in the case, the opponent was not entitled to be paid attorney's fees for that portion of the representation.
All right, but did you raise the issue of kind of double charging for fees, which I know you raised in your motion for reconsideration? Did that get raised in your original opposition?
You know, I really don't recall.
Okay, thank you.
Because I wasn't focusing on that today.
All right, thank you.
We're here today because our client, Jessica Snyder, sustained a broken shoulder for which she had surgery, closed surgery, rather than open reduction at first, which was unsuccessful. Then an open reduction and insertion of hardware, and then removal of that hardware many weeks later. Three surgeries for a broken shoulder, and absolutely not only uncontested but undisputed facts that she broke her shoulder and had to recover from that, and that is what the trial judge held was de minimis. In the face of that, we have a jury, we also have a stipulation that she sustained injuries from the fall at the school, and we have a jury verdict that found that the principal and the teacher were found to have been willful and wanton in their reckless disregard for the safety and welfare of this young lady, and that conduct was a cause of her injury. So what we and then the jury went ahead and apportioned the fault and found zero non-economic damages, and that is why we're here. It really boils down to a very simple question, and that is whether or not a broken shoulder, three surgeries, which is absolutely undisputed, can be, as a matter of law, can be considered to be de minimis. I think not. And I think that the case law, which we have cited, and which even the case law which the opposing counsel has cited, confirmed that. And very easily stated, the case law that developed with, and I don't describe each case because I know you've read them, but just the names of them, Thorpe, Bernchick, Staples, and King made clear not only is it an abuse of discretion, which is the standard on this issue, is it an abuse of discretion to not grant a new trial on the issue of damages only. The case law makes clear that if the trial court granted a new trial, that's not an abuse of discretion, and if they don't, it is an abuse of discretion. Then, after you consider those cases, which have some age on them, you come to the case of Lee versus Mobile Wash in 1993, where the court held that it was, in that case, they held that the jury's verdict should not result in a new trial when they found zero non-economic loss, because the injuries there, the jury could have found that, in fact, they were de minimis. But the reason that Lee's Mobile Wash is different than the case we're here on today is summarized, I think, in the court's opinion very nicely, and when they described in some detail why there wasn't anything that was stipulated to and anything that was undisputed about having any injury at all. That case turned on whether or not there was some brain injury. Tests at the scene by medical personnel indicated no injury. X-rays, EEG, and CAT scan conducted at that time and over the next several months in that case revealed no injury to the brain. And then there was a lot of other reason that the defendants in those case, in that case argued that there was other causes of the only injury that was in dispute. So there was nothing that was not in dispute in that case. Fortunately, in a case which we cited but didn't develop as well and didn't become as apparent that it should be developed more until after we saw the opposition brief and after we concluded our reply brief, a case that called Peterson, which is cited in our brief, compared Lee versus Mitchell and another case called Martinez, which is also cited in the brief, and determined that when it is absolutely undisputed that there is a real injury, that it is an abuse of discretion for the judge not to grant a new trial on the issue of damages only.
Mr. Freeman, let me ask you, and I understand the point you're making. In fact, I've got Peterson here as well. Talk about the evidence, if you would.
I will.
Did the other side here contest that your client had any injury? And I guess I had the impression their argument, maybe their argument was she was injured, but, you know, gee whiz, she was fine in a couple of weeks.
Well, here's the evidence. First of all, there was a fourth surgery a couple of years later. That was hotly contested. And while we argued to the jury that that was an injury for which she could recover, the jury had every right to hold that that is not a surgery for which she could recover as a result of this accident. But there was no evidence offered medically or otherwise by the defense, no lay testimony, no cross-examination of our medical expert that there wasn't a broken shoulder, that there wasn't a closed reduction operation the day of the accident, that there wasn't another surgery the next day in which the rods were put in, that the X-rays were somehow faulty, that the photographs showing the spikes sticking out of her arm weren't real, that she did not have to have the third surgery to remove the hardware, and that she didn't undergo physical therapy to become cured from that. There was nothing, no dispute, no competent evidence in opposition to that. That part of the case was uncontested and undisputed. Now, it is clever and for an attorney to try to extrapolate backwards from the fourth surgery to make what is left that was a very substantial injury anyway seem de minimis. But I put it to this panel as hard as I can that if this case did not involve the fourth surgery, if the entire case was the worst case scenario here, that she sustained a broken shoulder and had three surgeries and physical therapy, and that 5 weeks later, after many tens of thousands of dollars worth of bills, which aren't part of this case, but they're evidence of the extent of medical services that she required. The broken shoulder, three surgeries, X-rays, photographs, nothing in opposition to it, that would be a valid personal injury case, which would also be, as a matter of law, could not possibly be de minimis with zero damages. And that's the way you have to look at it.
I take it there was no evidence of any pre-existing injury. Is that true?
That's correct. There was no suggestion, not in opening statement, not in closing argument, or in any of the testimony or records in the case, that the injury to her shoulder happened from anything other than the fall at the dance. And that is that. And that is why, principally why, we are here. There was a stipulation in the case that our client was injured as a result of that fall. The argument they make now is that that injury was de minimis. The judge, in his order, cited the Lee's Mobile Wash and cited one other case, and in his opinion, he seemed to say that that case supported the same position, but the other case was the Martinez case, and in that, and it's decided in 93, this, just a few weeks or this earlier than the same year as Lee's Mobile Wash, and in that case, it was required that she get a new trial on the issue of damages. And so I was dumbfounded when I heard the jury say zero, and I was dumbfounded when I heard the judge say no new trial. I was so sure that we were right. We had our motion for new trial filed the same day, within hours of the time he entered his judgment. But that's his call. He's got to make a call one way or the other, and we believe he made a serious error here and deprived Jessica Snyder of her opportunity to recover for injuries that are not de minimis.
Let me ask you a quick question.
Sure.
Had the instructions been different and the jury allowed to determine, say, as little as $1 of damages, had the jury awarded $1 of damages, I take it your position would be the same.
It would.
That the evidence would not support that.
It would. And some of the case law makes clear that not just zero verdict, but insufficient verdict, same result. And it's interesting that you point that out, Judge Russell, because when you talk about jury instructions, one of the principal arguments made by our opposition here is that the words, if any, injuries, if any, in the jury instructions leaves it open for the jury to do that. But the case law makes clear that if the result is either plainly against the wording of the instruction or, and the word is or, not and, or against the evidence, that you have to reverse and remand for a new trial on the issue of damages only. Now, I would like to spend a moment on the issue raised by the other side. They've said in their brief that there's no evidence that they should have gotten a directed verdict with regard to Mr. Phillips and the teacher. And the reason that they argue that is that we are only arguing on an inference that they must have known what was going on. First of all, we're entitled to do that. But more than that, they have said there is absolutely no evidence in the record in this case that they did know what was going on before the disc was flipped and the crowd moved and fell on our client. Unfortunately, the record does not bear out that representation. Susan Snyder, the mother of the plaintiff, testified that Mr. Phillips told her on the Monday after the accident happened, the previous Friday, that he was, words to the effect that he knew that the DJ had been flipping the discs at the earlier dance that day. Now, that's not hearsay, that's an admission against interest of a party, and she testified to that effect, and that's in evidence and of record in this case. Moreover, Plaintiff's Exhibit 132, which is a letter from the insurance adjuster, Leonardo, to Mr. Bizdek, and all references to insurance were whited out of that letter. That letter, however, came into evidence and was read to Mr. Phillips, and in that letter, the judge ruled that comes in, because in that letter, Ms. Leonardo says that he, and the only he that the judge ruled that that could refer to, or at least that's arguable, was Mr. Phillips. He was aware that Mr. Bizdek had been flipping these discs at the earlier dance that day, and it had actually told him to stop, and it hadn't worked, and he kept on doing it. Taking all of that together to suggest there's no evidence that they had any prior knowledge in the face of three eyewitnesses who were there, saw these masses of children going after the discs time and time again, and when we have the principal and the teacher saying, if I had known that this was going on and didn't stop it, then I would be guilty of reckless disregard. And that's what happened. But we have evidence to that effect. And as to that issue, it's everything has to be resolved in favor of our clients. And if you take the evidence from Susan Snyder, the three eyewitness children, the plaintiff's exhibit 132, and the acknowledgement that this was reckless disregard by the principal and the teacher, if in fact they did know about it, then the judge was correct in denying the motion for directed verdict. I'll save a half a minute for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Scott Lassiter. I represent Roaring Fork RE1 School District, and I represent the principal, Mr. Phillips, and the teacher, Mrs. Green. Thank you. Please, the court.
I'd like to dispose of the attorney fee issue very quickly. That issue was not preserved. We filed our motion pursuant to, that was a 12B1 finding, so mandatory award of attorney's fees. It was a governmental immunity case. We prevailed, at least the school district prevailed on the motion. They objected to our entitlement to fees. They did not object to the amount, how it was divided, anything like that, and didn't actually bring that up for several months late until they, I don't know if they were told to do that or stumbled onto some case law or something, but it was not preserved, and they had missed their deadline to make the objection that they made. So that's the attorney's fees issue. The other two parts of this case are the liability aspect of the case, which we have filed a cross appeal, and the other aspect is the claim of inadequate damages. And we more or less concede that should the court find that the case stands on the jury's verdict, then the liability portion would not be an issue because the judgment would still enter for the defendant. So the effect of the case would be a judgment for the defendants. However, I would like to overview this with the liability part of the case. And then I'll spend the remainder of my time on the damages side of the case. So imagine, if you will, a sixth grade dance, and it's being held in a room really not unlike this room, except a lot deeper. And you have sixth grade children that the teachers are trying to encourage to be sociable and to interact with each other, and they like to do fun things. And so this was a Halloween dance, one of the most well-intentioned activities that there can be in a school district. It's a dance. It wasn't a basketball game, it wasn't a wrestling match, wasn't a violent football game, it was just a dance. There was a DJ that was hired that sat in a staging area, much like the Quarry City now, and the children were wallflowers. They haven't really developed their social skills yet. And this was a very heavily supervised dance. There were more teachers and more parents, more adults at this dance than there were at any other activity that the school holds. Very well supervised. The principal was even there. Of course, he's a defendant. The teacher was there. Of course, she's a defendant. There were many other teachers, many other adults, many other parents, cafeteria workers, people of that kind. So here are the kids, and they're not, you know, super interacting, and the DJ wants to get them engaged. That's what you'd like to do with your children, teach them to be socially engaged. So playing music, and they're trying to dance and have fun, and the DJ takes a CD, and he tosses it, encouraging the kids, you know, to, hey, you know, interact and come together and so forth. So he did that, and the kids did come together, and they were trying to, like kids, I guess, will do, trying to get their free CD. And so a bit of a jumbling of children occurred. Now, it wasn't a crowd that fell on Ms. Schneider. It was one of the teachers. It was Mrs. Green that fell backwards and lost her footing. Can you imagine? Lost her footing. No intentions whatsoever to hurt this young child or to hurt anybody else. She just lost
her. Counsel, just kind of cutting to the chase.
Absolutely.
Here. Do you agree that both Ms. Green and the principal, whose name has escaped me a second, I thought Phillips.
Mr. Phillips
said that had they seen the DJ throwing the CDs and had they not done anything about it, that would be reckless disregard. Do you agree that they said that?
I agree that they said a version of that. I think what they said is that if they saw the DJ creating some kind of a mayhem or dangerous situation, they would have put a stop to it. And in fact, they did. The evidence was that they did put a stop to it.
Okay, so they at least admit if they saw whatever, creating some ruckus or the kids run whatever, and they didn't put a stop, that would be reckless. So isn't the issue then, was there any evidence that they saw it and didn't do anything about it?
And
you need those two pieces,
yeah,
right?
And didn't do anything about it.
Right, would you agree with that? So if there's evidence of those two pieces, then there's sufficient evidence for the jury to find against your clients, right?
No,
based
I don't.
On their own admission.
First of all, I believe when Mr. Phillips testified to that, it was over objection because we claimed that that's a legal standard that he's not capable of addressing. But nonetheless, if the CD is tossed And, you know, there's not a big, you know, pile on of kids, so to speak, to try to get to the CD. But if it's real amenable, you know, there's no danger that appears as a result of tossing that CD, then he wouldn't agree that it's still reckless conduct. And
I think you're maybe not understanding my question, and I apologize if I'm not asking it properly, so stop me.
Okay.
But you agree with me, I think, that Mr. Phillips, whether over objection or not, testified that had he seen this ruckus or whatever else and did nothing about it, that would be reckless disregard.
Well, I think he did testify to that in okay. that way. In other words, if he saw a danger happening, he would stop it. Just like a schoolyard fight, just like a fight on the basketball court, yes, he would stop that.
Then would you agree with me that the analysis for purpose, and I understand you disagree vehemently that they did anything wrong, I got it, but the question for purposes of whether a directed verdict should have been granted is whether there was some evidence on those two aspects, you know, whether the defendants here saw it and whether they didn't do anything. If there was evidence that they saw it and didn't do anything, by their own admission, there would be reckless disregard.
If they saw a dangerous condition,
yes,
yeah, not just the tossing of the CD, but an actual danger that resulted therefrom.
Absolutely, okay, and I'll take that. So then the question really becomes whether there was any evidence of these two things, correct? Sufficient to allow a jury to make that conclusion.
And whether such evidence arose to the level of willful and wanton.
Okay.
And see, for purposes of this, we're conceding all the facts that they say. Okay, we're conceding that because I think that's the standard, at least for summary judgment. You view things in light most favorable, and we filed a motion for summary judgment. You view things in light most favorable to the non-moving party. So we're sort of conceding all these facts and saying, even if it happened exactly this way, that does not rise to the level of willful and wanton conduct, at least not as described by the case law.
So what, in your view, is the significance of your client's admission? Is it? It's, you're clearly saying it's not a binding formal admission. You're just saying that your client made a statement that we're entitled to consider for whatever legal effect it has.
Correct. But the admission notwithstanding, there's got to be real hard evidence. You know, there's got to be real live evidence of the things that establish liability. There has to be evidence of purposeful conduct. There has to be evidence that the actor, that is Mr. Phillips and Mrs. Green, were fully aware of the danger and deliberately avoided all precaution to prevent disaster. That's what the case law says willful and wanton is. And it's really important that, you know, this is not a negligence case, not against my clients at least. It's a willful and wanton case because it's a governmental immunity.
Well, let me ask you, counsel, let's take the hypothetical. The DJ just throws a CD and 100 kids rush at it in the middle, scrambling to get the CD. Is it your position that that's not enough to let a jury conclude that that was a dangerous situation?
Yes, in part. And you know why? Because they have school districts all over the world have basketball games. I mean, can you imagine a basketball game? The players are running and jumping for the ball. Same with football games, albeit, you know, football players maybe have head protection, things like that. Basketball players don't. Kids, they rush out to the school bus to get to be the first one on the bus to get home. They rush to be the first one in the lunch line. And so there's this coming together of children in all these different contexts and circumstances. And now we're going to say, hey, if that kid falls down or if somebody trips on him running to the bus or running to the lunch line or going up for a basketball, we're going to find that the coach or the lunch lady or the bus attendant is legally responsible for those injuries. That's not the intent of the law in Colorado, and I don't think it's the intent of the law in any jurisdiction in this country. But yes, that's our position. And I think this Pettingill versus Modi case, Colorado Supreme Court case, really sets forth the important features of these willful and wanton cases. And, you know, that case even said that willful and wanton means by choice, intentional, purposeful, and it may at times imply an element of evil. That's the gist of this, the heart of these cases. There was nothing like that in this case. It's just an innocent little school dance. And the DJ threw a CD, he tossed it. As soon as the principal saw that happen, he went to tell the DJ, that that's probably not a good idea to
but
do.
But there was evidence on the other side of that, wasn't there? I mean, there are a couple of witnesses, albeit maybe circumstantial, from witnesses said, I didn't see any of the principal or Mrs. Green go up and tell the DJ anything. There was evidence to that effect, I think, cited in the plaintiff's brief. Why doesn't that get you to the jury?
Why doesn't that get us to the jury? Well, it did, apparently, with this judge.
And you said it shouldn't have.
It shouldn't have. Because that's just not a legally sufficient set of facts. There's no evil intent. There's no deliberateness. There's no choice.
But it also includes recklessness. That it's a known risk. If this DJ threw $1 million bill in the middle of the floor, and now you have all the kids racing for it, you got all the parents racing for it, and yes, somebody gets hurt, you still don't concede that that creates a dangerous condition that someone should have recognized?
More so than a basketball game, more so than a football game,
no one is throwing an object that's intended that 100 or 200, how many people at the dance race for this, what is a CD, 9 square inches?
Yeah,
everybody's
very small.
Going after a 9 square inch disc on a gym floor at the same time. You don't concede that that creates a dangerous situation?
The principal thought that it was going to create a dangerous situation, but as a matter of law, under the willful and wanton standard, I don't think that's a dangerous situation, not any more so than a basketball game.
Well,
I think that's the important point.
Mr. Lassiter, in a basketball game, you have rules, and you have a referee, usually more than one, to enforce those rules, and perhaps more important, you have players who understand that there may be this contact. In fact, they arguably seek it out, and they're on their guard. Because of the nature of the game and the nature of the rules and the fact that they know that a referee is there and may call them for a foul. You don't have any of that here. I mean, we've just got a mob, sounds like to me.
But despite that, there's more injuries in the basketball game than there are at school dances by leaps and bounds. And this school dance was much more supervised than a basketball game. There were teachers and parents everywhere. So, you know, I understand the question, but from a willful and wanton standpoint, in a governmental immunity case, not a negligence case, I don't think this whole set of facts comes anywhere close. And that's why we moved for direct verdict, and that's why we moved for summary judgment in the first place.
Mr. Lassiter, can I ask, I know you've got about 2 minutes left. I'd really like to hear your argument on the damages issue.
Yes. So, okay.
Go for it.
All right, so I've got very limited time. First of all, instruction 22 was tendered by the plaintiffs and given, and it said the question of whether or not damages are to be awarded is a question for the jury's consideration. We have all kinds of cases, the Lee's mobile wash case and other cases where non-economic damages are not given, and the court upholds that. The Supreme Court in Lee's mobile wash upheld a finding in a claim brain injury case.
That was for the reasons Mr. Freeman pointed out. There was evidence that there was no injury at all.
Yes.
And that there was pre-existing injury in that case.
Yes. A lot of these cases come down to the evidence. And what really motivated the jury and the judge, obviously, is the lack of quality evidence as to her injury. Yes, she fell.
A broken shoulder and 3 surgeries in a week, and that's lack of quality evidence?
It's even the term surgery was very disputed in the trial. The evidence was that one surgery was to manipulate her shoulder, but that was done, they just put her under and she had no pain. They put her under and they just manipulated the shoulder. There was no cutting, there's no slicing, but they call that a surgery. The next time was when they numbed up her shoulder and put a pin in her shoulder. Again, very little evidence of actually no evidence of pain and suffering, evidence of the fact that a pin was put in, that was it. The third surgery they're claiming was the pin being removed. There was no quality evidence in this case, and that's really that's a huge, huge thing in this case.
You're saying there was no evidence that she had pain. I understand. So, okay, you're saying she had no pain and suffering in the surgery because she was under anesthesia, I guess. You're saying there was no evidence that she suffered pain from this broken shoulder?
Right. Somebody should have got up in the trial and got on the witness stand and said, oh, my shoulder hurt so bad, I cried and cried and cried, and she was in agony, and she had all these problems and stuff like that. Wasn't the case. The doctors, within just a couple of weeks, said she was fine. She went on to letter and golf. There was a dispute as to whether these were even characterized as surgeries, whether she even felt it, but there was no evidence on the witness stand. Nobody said, what the, there was any pain or there was any suffering. Also, the plaintiff herself, she just said, I just remember my shoulder was sore and I couldn't go trick-or-treating that night. And that was it. There was no evidence.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired.
Thank you so much.
The mother, the father, and the plaintiff testified about the extreme pain that she underwent, at least during those 5 weeks and well beyond it. I wanted to answer Judge Gabriel's question about the motion relating to the fees. The judge, the day before trial, at volume 6, pages 713 to 717, passed an order on various pending motions, and in that order, July 30th, he, for the first time, assessed what the attorney's fees would be and how he calculated that. And then on August 16th, we filed the motion for reconsideration, having seen for the first time how he was allocating the fees, asking him to reconsider how he allocated it. Thank you.
Thank you. Court thanks counsel for their argument.